From WBUR Boston, I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The 1965 Voting Rights Act represented a major victory of the civil rights movement. It confronted voter intimidation and ended bigoted policies to keep blacks away from the polls. This week, 48 years later, the Supreme Court struck down the act's key enforcement provision, saying times have changed. The decision frees mostly southern states to run their elections without federal oversight. It sharply divided the court and reignited a hot debate about race and voting rights. This hour on Point, Southern Voices on Race and the Voting Rights Act and Voting Rights Today. And joining me now from Clemson, South Carolina, we're joined by Orville Vernon Burton. He's born in Royston, Georgia, raised in South Carolina, longtime scholar of the American South, race relations. He served many times as an expert witness on voting rights related cases in Texas, Georgia, and South Carolina. He's professor at Clemson University and author of The Age of Lincoln. And Vernon Burton, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And joining us from Norman, Oklahoma, is Keith Gaddy, born and raised outside Louisville, Kentucky. He's professor of political science at the University of Oklahoma and author of The Triumph of Voting Rights in the South. Keith, welcome to you. Good to have you.
Hello, Anthony.
And finally, joining us now is Kareem Creighton. He's professor at the University of North Carolina School of Law, born and raised in Montgomery, Alabama. He's devoted his career to Southern politics and voting rights. And in fact, he was the lead author of one of the amicus briefs filed in the case the Supreme Court ruled on this week. And he joins us today from Anchorage, Alaska. Kareem, welcome to you. Welcome to On Point.
Good to be with you.
And Kareem, I'm going to start with you with just a couple of sort of basic questions to bring our listeners up to date with this decision. In striking down Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act, this was the key enforcement provision. What's left of the Voting Rights Act? Is anything left?
Well, as a technical matter, everything else in the Act remains valid. So Section 5, which is actually a substantive rule that basically requires certain designated states to get federal permission before enacting a new change in their law, remains on the books. The key to this, of course, is that by invalidating Section 4, the court basically has said that there's no place in the country currently that has to comply with the rule in Section 5.
Right. And let's be clear about where these protections had been imposed. The law had applied to 9 states, mostly in the South, Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, South Carolina, Virginia, and Texas, but also parts of Alaska, parts of other states as well, New York, New Hampshire. But clearly the focus of this was in the South. Do we have that right?
That's correct. The origin of this statute in 1965 was a direct response to what happened in part on the bridge in Selma of nonviolent African-American marchers protesting the denial of voting rights in violation of the 15th Amendment. But of course, that had been a fight that had been waged since basically the early 1900s. And so Congress decided to act initially at getting at the places that were most persistent in denying the right to vote, and that definitely included the places in the Deep South. But since that time in the 1970s, that scope was expanded to include similar circumstances for language minorities, Latinos, Asian Americans, mm-hmm. Native Americans, and so that took it into other parts of the country as well.
Mm. So in the case before the High Court, Shelby County v. Holder, what was the central complaint of Southern election officials who challenged this part of the Voting Rights Act?
Well, this is the interesting piece of the story. Shelby County is a county in Alabama, and they made the argument that, 1965 was certainly a bad time, and nobody questions that the rule should have applied then, but current circumstances are so different that maybe this is not as warranted as before. And the same argument technically was made a few years back in a case out of Texas, Northwest Austin, and the court seemed to look at the matter and raise some doubts about whether or not it could be applied in the same manner based on current evidence. The best argument that I think that they offered is, well, look, we've got a president who's non-white, and he was elected notwithstanding the fact that, we've got a lot of different people, some of whom don't necessarily embrace racial equality. But that's got to be a sign that things are better now than before. And so the court looks at that evidence and says, apparently, it just doesn't make sense to have a statute that explicitly talks about the world as it existed in 1965 and continue to maintain the same sort of oversight given all of these changes that have occurred. And nobody questions whether the number of African Americans who are registered and voting, and certainly other non-white groups too, have increased in these jurisdictions. The question is just whether things have improved to the extent that this is no longer needed. Congress in 2006 decided more time was needed. The court seems to say, well, we're not so sure.
So interesting to look at some of the words that Chief Justice John Roberts wrote. Our country has changed, he wrote, during that time, meaning the last 40 years, largely because of the Voting Rights Act. Voting tests were abolished, disparities in voter registration and turnout due to race was erased, and African Americans attained political office in record numbers. So his argument is basically it is no longer needed. The Voting Rights Act pretty much has accomplished what it needed to accomplish, right?
That's the basis of his argument. He sees that there's not really a logical relationship between the formula that's in the statute, which again is identifying places based on their conditions in 1965, and what he looks around and sees, as you pointed out, these significant improvements in terms of political participation. And so because he sees no logical relationship, he and four of the justices say this can't stand any longer.
And sharply divided decision. Ruth Bader Ginsburg summarized her dissent from the bench, which is highly unusual, saying the nation's commitment to justice has been harmed by this decision. What's at the core of the dissent here?
Well, I think there are two points. First is that there is a concern about whether the world that Chief Justice Roberts sees is a world that indicates there have been jurisdictions that have actually gotten the lesson of Section 5, so that without Section 5, they would continue to do the kind of good work and continue these improvements, or whether the world is such that actually the results are primarily due to the continued oversight of Section 5, and that without it, there might be essentially backsliding, which is exactly what Congress thought about when it devised the statutory provision in 1965 and decided to renew it, by the way, in 2006. I think the other point that dissent makes, and I think it's an important one, is, you know, ultimately, this is a judgment that a legislature makes.
Mm-hmm.
They look at data, and they make considered judgments. And you know what? They may be right, they may be wrong, but they need to be respected. And insofar as it was a bipartisan majority making the decision, it was overwhelmingly approved by a Republican-controlled Congress and signed by a Republican president. It doesn't seem to be the role of the court, in Justice Ginsburg's view, to sort of second-guess that decision, absent some overwhelming problem.
Mm-hmm.
And the other important point to see in this, and that she brings up, is, you know, Shelby County is not necessarily the best party to bring up this claim. By most any measure, Shelby County has violated Section 5 and has been objected to by the federal government such that they couldn't enact plans that the federal government found to be threatening to minority voting rights. So Shelby County and Alabama more generally are actually sort of poster states and jurisdictions, if you will,
sure,
for showing why there's a need for Section 5.
Vernon Burton, I'd like to come to you for just a brief comment. Then we're going to return after the break and really dive deep into this. But you take issue with the decision by the Supreme Court this week. I'd like to ask you why.
Yes, I think it's very wrong. I think it's very eerie that you quoted Judge Roberts. Those words about times have changed are almost the same that came out of Scott v. Emerson. That's Missouri Supreme Court that becomes Dred Scott. I think that this will be one of the cases where we will celebrate Judge Ginsburg's dissenting view, just like we do Justice Harlan's on Plessy v. Ferguson. And I don't understand, I think it was a good summary, exactly why this was done. There was a huge record before Congress in 2006. It's not really referred to except for registration and turnout. And, of course, registration and turnout, when the Voting Rights Act was passed, it was passed to change that. And Section 5 was put in not because of registration and turnout, but as a way, in fact, to take care of those secondary kind of generation discriminatory practices, such as at-large annexation, the redistricting practices, or I would add the voter ID case where I was expert witness against the South Carolina voter ID just this year. So I think it's a bad decision, and I am not an attorney, so I do not want to speak to the legal side of it, but I just do not see that it makes sense given the record that was before Congress and not referring to it that Judge Ginsburg speaks to very well. Another thing, I think
Vernon Burton, I'm just going to jump in because we have to go to a break. There's a lot that we need to sort of say about this argument. We're going to come back to you, give you a lot of time to make your point as well. Keith Gaddy, hold on, and Kareem Creighton. Listeners, we're talking about the Supreme Court's decision this week to strike down the heart of the Voting Rights Act. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the Supreme Court decision this week to strike down key provisions of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, and in the view of the court's minority and many scholars, to effectively gut the whole law. My guests this hour are Vernon Burton in Clemson, South Carolina. He's a professor of history at Clemson University. Kareem Creighton is a professor at the University of North Carolina School of Law in Chapel Hill. And joining us today from Anchorage, Alaska, is Keith Gaddy. He's a professor of political science at the University of Oklahoma and the author of The Triumph of Voting Rights in the South. And Vernon Burton, before the break, you were on the verge of making a second point about your concerns about this decision. I wanted you to pick right up right there.
There are a lot of things, but I'll try to quickly just say that one of the things I've been reading since this decision is how the South is glad, or Southern states are glad. That's really, as a Southern historian, I want to say that there are a lot of African Americans in the South who are not glad that the Voting Rights Act, Section 4, has been ruled unconstitutional. And certainly a lot of whites like myself who are Southerners, who we know our state. I wanted to point out that, you know, municipalities, even states, could opt out if you have a 10-year clean record of doing nothing. So that is really disturbing. And certainly Shelby County did not have that clean record at all, even in 2010. All of the record before Congress that Justice Ginsburg cites shows, in fact, that it is these covered states, even under the old formula, where most of the Section 2 cases have come and been settled or are either ruled in favor of the minority plaintiffs, and that most of the objections go to with Section 5. Now, voting rights are a national problem, but it has been shown, particularly by scholars, that racial polarization, that is, where most whites vote for whites, most African-Americans or minorities will vote for an African-American candidate, is strong throughout the country, but it's even stronger in the South, and particularly those states that are covered, which then means it makes it more difficult for African-Americans to have a meaningful vote to elect candidates of their choice.
All right, Vernon Burton, hold that thought, because I want to get Keith Gaddy into this conversation. And Keith, professor of political science at the University of Oklahoma, I take it that your view on this, sort of a split decision in your view, and I'd like to get your sort of more nuanced view of this decision this week from the Supreme Court.
Well, Anthony, I appreciate you getting to me, and it's good to be on the air again with Kareem and Vernon, who I had dinner with a few months ago. This is an avoidable tragedy, would be the best way to put it. Congress was told in 2005 and 2006 by several legal scholars and historians and political scientists that there were potential defects in the coverage formula. And the coverage formula, when you look at it, is technically a race-neutral formula. It's based on registration and participation figures and the historic use of a test or device to qualify to vote. Now, tests and devices are permanently banned in the United States thanks to one of the subsequent renewals of the Voting Rights Act. But one thing that's happened over time is we've had changes in areas where we have low participation. And one of the arguments that myself and Rick Hassan and Rick Pildes made to Congress was they needed to consider an updated coverage formula that would keep in areas that had low participation or hold out the prospect of bringing in jurisdictions as participation fell. There are parts of the South that are in desperate need of keeping Section 5 coverage, of keeping pre-clearance in, Randolph County, Georgia being a wonderful case example where we have extraordinary participation problems in that county.
There are also parts of the South, and I think John Roberts pointed this out, where voter participation has increased dramatically, obviously, in the last 40 years. For instance, black registration in Mississippi, less than 7% in 1965. It's now up at 76%, higher even than white voter registration. So that's an indication of how times have changed, right?
Well, it is. But, you know, again, if you looked at Mississippi and you looked at it with a higher degree of granularity, what you'd see is higher African-American participation. But many counties in that state still have low participation problems and still have racial discrimination problems in their elections. Mm-hmm. So parts of Mississippi still need close scrutiny. The whole goal of the act was a response to an argument was made by Ross Barnett, the old governor of Mississippi, that legislatures can change laws faster than courts can overturn them. So we have Section 2 of the Act, which can react, and which is where most gains have been made in minority representation and participation. But it takes a lot longer to litigate these things than to stop them before they're implemented. But we've also got problems in other parts of the country, other parts of the South that aren't covered currently, Indian country, parts of the West. If you ask me the two states where the greatest concern is for getting rid of Section 5, I would say Texas and Arizona, which were fully covered by Section 5 and where we have some of the most probably some of the most obnoxious and divisive efforts to disfranchise Hispanics in the U.S.
So, Keith Getty, are you saying that the need for that kind of close scrutiny in those states, for example, as well as parts of the South, are going to be virtually impossible in the light of this decision this week?
Well, no. I guess what I'm saying is it used to be that a state or a jurisdiction would propose to change the law, mm-hmm. and then they'd have to go get approval either from the federal courts or the Department of Justice to make the change. Now what they can do is they can change the law, implement the law, and you're going to have to sue. And what happens is the burden of proof shifts away from the state or the jurisdiction and shifts towards the plaintiff. Mm. So DOJ is going to have to prove these jurisdictions have discriminated rather than the jurisdiction proving that they don't.
Mm. So we've got a lot of listeners backed up here, and I want to get them into this conversation. But Kareem Creighton, let me come back to you with just one more question before we go to our callers. And this sort of picks up on what Keith Gaddy's talking about, and I guess I would file it under sort of immediate practical consequences. Shortly after this decision, for example, Texas announced that a voter identification law that had been blocked would go into effect immediately. Is that the kind of consequence that might be a source of concern in the wake of this decision?
That is precisely the source of concern. And I want to try to bring together the comments that both Keith and Vernon made, because I think they're important to bear in mind. Justice Roberts says times have changed, but it turns out that, you know, history does have a cyclical nature about it. And it's important to bear in mind, which is one of the things that Congress did in 2006, that continued vigilance, that is, continued use of Section 5, was important because we found that in instances where the federal government removes this sort of intervention too early, there's nothing more than retrenchment that happens. The Supreme Court at the end of the 19th century decided that it was no longer important for the U.S. Constitution to demand federal involvement, and what happened was Jim Crow. Now, it's not a suggestion that we're going to get exactly to the same world that the Bull Connors of the world brought to places like Alabama. But the decision that Texas, South Carolina, and now North Carolina are all making, basically doing these sorts of efforts in erecting new barriers to the right to vote without restraint, indicates that they never really got the lesson of Section 5, that is to adopt laws that at least take into account the concerns of minority citizens. And Keith is exactly right. These things are going to end up in court in a very time-consuming and, frankly, expensive process, the very kind of expense that these states are claiming that they are trying to avoid. And more important than that, it's going to bear a significant burden on the very people who we all agree have suffered exclusion, outright political exclusion, for about a century. And so that's sort of the irony in this decision that I think Chief Justice Roberts has authored.
Let's go to some calls. Allie is calling from Hilton Head, South Carolina. Hi, Allie. You're on the air.
Hi, Anthony. Glad to be a part of the conversation. I was really disappointed in the decision. I should say first, I'm a white woman, so, and I come from a middle-class family, so I'm kind of coming from a position of privilege, and I don't pretend to speak from the perspective of someone who's been disenfranchised. But to me, when we look at the Voting Rights Act and think we don't need those protections because times are different now, we think so because we don't see people going after blacks with fire hoses. But that's no longer where the fault line is. And it's an improvement, but it turns a blind eye to the real problem, which is structural inequality. That's where the disenfranchisement comes from, poverty, problems in the schools, things like that. And I'd love to hear what your guests have to say in response.
Allie, thanks for bringing that point and putting it on the table. Vernon Burton, let me have you respond to Allie. She's talking about this decision not recognizing structural inequality. Is that an important point to raise?
It's a very important point in terms of people's ability to have a meaningful vote. And I would like to add, too, because I was at University of Illinois for 34 years and always wanted to come home, and I've come back to the South. And it's of course, the South has changed and changed for the better in race relations, but it's also changed another way. The cultural wars have had a terrible effect, I believe. And in particular, the way the political system developed in the South with the 1964 Civil Rights Act and then the Voting Rights Act, that you really cannot separate out partisan politics and race in the South. And that's different in the rest of the nation. So it gets very confused and very complex. And I think Section 5, while not perfect, at least it got the it was prophylactic and got some of the most egregious problems that worked against the kind of structural and problems of wealth and inequalities and things like that that would make it harder for people, minorities, particularly in the South, particularly African Americans in the South and a growing Hispanic population, to have a meaningful vote to elect the candidate of their choice.
Mm. Well, let's take another call. Mike is calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi, Anthony. Yeah, I just wanted to say I think the decision was wonderful. I think it's something that is going to serve this country exceptionally well, and for this reason, I think it, the comments that have been made the last few minutes illustrate this. Expectations have gone way up, and as I think the previous caller said, something about the fault line being moved. Well, I mean, that's what's happened. We've gone from expecting people to have equal opportunities to vote to now wanting to get specific results. And this is not the legitimate role of government. If people don't turn out to vote and they have an opportunity to vote, which they do, that should be fine. There's no reason why candidates of a particular race have to be elected.
Mm-hmm. Mike, I really appreciate you bringing this point to the table. Keith Gaddy, let me get you to respond to Mike, who's basically saying if people don't want to vote, they don't have to vote. They can vote. So he applauds this decision.
Well, and, going back to also to what Vernon Burton just said in response to the previous caller, a lot of the secondary barriers to voting have largely been eliminated among African Americans. You look at socioeconomic status of a black voter versus a white voter, a black voter is more likely to turn out. The real barrier is with Asian and Hispanic voters who are having trouble getting to the franchise even if they are citizens. They are not effectively mobilized, not effectively included in the process. You know, do you get there with Section 5? Not necessarily. Most of the gains come from Section 2 and then Section 5 being available to institutionalize those gains that were achieved either through the incorporation of Section 2 or through litigation in those Section 5 states. But, you know, the problem here is I'm going to disagree with the caller in part because what we've lost here is we've lost coverage in areas where we need it. We've gained the opportunity to implement coverage where we can get it. I don't think Congress is going to pass it. I think that the states' rights crowd in the U.S. House in particular is so strong you will never move legislation through this Congress to restore a coverage trigger. Mm. And I think it's going to contribute to a divisive environment through the rest of the summer.
Kareem Creighton, I want to ask you about what Keith Gaddy just said about Congress, because, of course, the decision by the Supreme Court did say, you know, if Congress wants to redefine, sharpen the language about these provisions, it's free to do that. And the Voting Rights Act is still on the books. Keith Gaddy doesn't think it's very likely that could happen in Congress. What about you? Because already folks like Patrick Leahy from Vermont saying that he's going to take steps immediately to bolster voting rights protections in Congress. Is that likely or unlikely?
Well, I think it's fair to say that we've learned in this this particular term that the Chief Justice is a shrewd character. I think he is clearly aware that by essentially saying, oh, Congress, if you'd like to return to this issue, we are more than willing to hear, you know, in a different setting, a formula that's updated. I'm sure he was aware of, yes, the current political climate in Congress, which hasn't produced very much at all, even on things that most of us desire. The open question, though, is whether the outrage about this decision, I think there's a considerable amount of it, and the immediate moves, as we've just been talking about, that a lot of these states who couldn't have adopted these statutes that they're pursuing before Chief Justice Roberts issued this decision will motivate some people to actually consider this. Again, as I said, in 2006, it was a Republican Congress and a Republican president who reauthorized the Voting Rights Act. So it's important to bring up. And let me mention one other thing, because I think it's relevant to the comment both that Keith made and also somewhat, I think, of a misguided view that came from the caller. That is about what the right to vote is. I know a lot of people seem to take the view that if you can cast a ballot, that that is sufficient in order to sort of realize the promise of the 15th Amendment. But I think none of us would actually want to live in a world as in Iran or in a number of other totalitarian states where everybody actually gets a chance to cast a ballot, but the ballot isn't counted fairly, or the structures are in place so that ballot is not effectively given full value. That's really the question that we're concerned about at this stage with respect to current conditions. And in those respects, there are still significant differences in Section 5 jurisdictions versus not. And it's important to see that the right that we're talking about isn't the right to just elect people who are of the same race as you. We're talking about even candidates who are white, who are preferred by African Americans in these jurisdictions, who consistently get voted out. And again, there's plenty of evidence that we submitted to the court showing that in Section 5 jurisdictions, that is less likely to have white support non-white preferred candidates, whether they're black or white.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. We're hearing this hour a Southern perspective on race, change, and the Voting Rights Act in the wake of this week's Supreme Court decision. Here's President Lyndon Baines Johnson in an address to Congress in March 1965, 5 months before he signed the Voting Rights Act into law. He was laying out a moral basis for the law. Let's listen.
Their cause must be our cause, too. Because it's not just Negroes, but really it's all of us who must overcome the crippling legacy of bigotry and injustice. And we shall overcome.
President Lyndon B. Johnson speaking in 1965, 5 months before he signed the Voting Rights Act into law. My guests this hour are Keith Gaddy, professor of political science at the University of Oklahoma, Vernon Burton, professor of history at Clemson University in Clemson, South Carolina, and Kareem Creighton, professor at the University of North Carolina School of Law in Chapel Hill. And gentlemen, before I want to really use this last section of our talk to really talk about sort of what it feels like and what's going on in the South today. And Vernon Burton, let me come to you first, because you were away from the South. I understand you're teaching in the Midwest for a while. You came back home. What did you find? What's the feeling there with regards to these issues that we're talking about?
Well, as I said, first of all, race is not just a Southern problem. It's a world problem. It's certainly an American problem. But in the South, because of the history, particularly in election law, Congress was able to do something with the Voting Rights Act about that specific area. And certainly the South is so much better in terms of those sort of race issues. But old habits are hard to change, particularly when they're linked, in fact, with this extraordinary integral link between race and party in the South. And I do think that there has been an intensification, as I said, as part of the cultural wars, not the kind of old sense of racism we had. For example, when I grew up in 96 South Carolina, I think that not only was there race, but there was sort of a class element as well. And what I see now is, and we knew there was class, they played golf, we went fishing. But people don't think of class very much in the South now as whites and blacks. And this is not true at all. The historical record is there. But people will say, you know, among whites, they'll say, well, we pay taxes and they have welfare. It's this kind of stereotypical thing. And I don't think there is a basis for it. I like to point out one of the things that's happened that I think have made these sort of issues worse, and why you have racial polarization in voting increasing instead of decreasing, even from 2008 to 2012 with President Obama's election, has been that with the civil rights movement, there really wasn't a justification, at least an intellectual or a theological justification for segregation, as there had been the big arguments on pro-slavery. But with the sort of talk radio and so much of the television broadcasters who have come on strong in the culture wars, I think it's given people a sense that there is an intellectual basis that sort of justifies their old habits and attitudes about race. This is not to say that people aren't treating each other better and there are no these horrible laws and things, but I think it does affect, particularly in the political arena, how people have the opportunity, and I'm glad somebody straightened out, it's the opportunity to vote, to have an equal vote cast. It has nothing to do with about who is elected, but that your vote is counted. There are all sorts of ways to make a vote count less. Mm. It doesn't have to do with your predicting an outcome at all.
Keith Gaddy, I'd like to sort of get you to respond to some of this. And I guess what I'm my question is, you know, one of the points I want to be really careful not to make is that some and Vernon Burton sort of made reference to this, that when we talk about the problems of racism, this is no longer, it never was, just a problem that resided only in the South. So, you know, to what extent is it fair to sort of applaud John Roberts and sort of, I don't know, trying to remove this idea that this is predominantly a Southern problem and that this decision in a way kind of opens up this discussion, I guess, to looking at this problem across the country in a wider way, in a different way.
Well, you know, first of all, we all wish we lived in the world that looked exactly like the one that John Roberts described.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, black and white Southerners, black and white politicians in the South have described the South that he described, and you know, but political circumstance comes into play. The South John Roberts described sounds like the South that John Lewis described in the Georgia v. Ashcroft litigation 10 years ago, and Lewis has since backed off of that position and moved a bit more towards a skeptical view of progress in the South. And Representative Lewis has the ultimate moral authority on these issues, has been beaten into a coma twice in pursuit of voting rights. But there are three Souths. And two of them are growing and one isn't. Two of them are progressing and one isn't. There is a dynamic, diverse urban South that you find in Nashville and Atlanta and Charlotte and Richmond and Charleston and places like that. Austin, Texas, good example of the new modern urban South, the sophisticated South. There is a suburban South that tends to be a bit more concerned with money and consumerism, and it's a bit more segregated. But the values of a middle-class black or a middle-class white or a middle-class Hispanic suburb are not that different in terms of the day-to-day pursuit of life, but they're not as well integrated. And then you got this last South, this rural South, that's out in the old Cotton Belt, and it's down in the Delta, and it's down in the South Valley of Texas. And down there, race and class mix a little more starkly. And the power base is mainly in rural white landowners. And that South isn't changing as easily or as effectively And that's the South that went most radically Republican over the last 20 years. And down in that South, you don't know if change is ever going to come. And as my colleague Joe Stewart at Clemson, a friend of mine in Burnham's, observed, sometimes progress only comes one funeral at a time. And for some of these areas, it may take the passing of the last generation raised in Jim Crow before you see the challenge go away. Bill Bishop down in Austin, Texas, talks about a lot of this in his book, The Big Sort, and I'd recommend it to any of your listeners who have not read it. It's a sophisticated problem, and what we need is we need a law that will allow us to identify the places in need of coverage, in need of remediation, so we can get at them, because they're not just Southern.
Sure. Well, we've got some great calls lined up. Let's go to a couple more of them. Cutler is calling from Sumter, South Carolina. Hi, Cutler. You're on the air.
Hi, Anthony. How are y'all doing?
Very well. Good to have you. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to, especially what your guest just said there, I wanted to confirm exactly what he said about the rural South. Me being from the rural South, it is a situation like he just described. And me being mid-30s, I have grown up with it to witness it firsthand. It is not something that is going away anytime soon. It is very much like he described, where you kind of have to wait on it funeral by funeral to go away. And, you know, like great people have always taught me, racism is something that's not inherited, it's taught. It is not something that you are born with. It is something that you are brought up with.
So, Cutler, does that tell you, I mean, I'm interested to know, sort of cut to the chase here, your gut reaction about the Supreme Court decision today, does it worry you?
It strikes a great amount of fear in me, yes, sir. And it's only exacerbated by the quick actions in Texas, my home state, in North Carolina, and the fact that Shelby County is actually a very rural county that brought this to the Supreme Court. It only speaks volumes to what the problem really is. And the fact that the justices paint a picture that's so inaccurate, so distinctly inaccurate from what is really happening in today's world, it really worries me going forward in my life. I mean, I'm only 33 years old. I have, you know, the rest of my life ahead of me. And if something like this is gutted because, you know, their excuse is we've changed, I'm sorry, but when you watch news outlets today, they're exacerbating racism even more so than they were 10, 15 years ago.
All right.
It is not something that's away anytime.
Cutler, I'm going to jump in just because your line is breaking up, but you made your point beautifully, and we appreciate it. Let's go to Jay, who's calling from Quincy, Mass. Hi, Jay, you're on the air.
Hi, Anthony. There's evidence that there is a newfound political power in the black community nationwide and in the South. We're focusing on racism, the racism of the white, and not on the gains of the black population, and it is enormous. It is that power that power brokered the effort to elect the first black president of this country. There are many black congressmen in the South now as there are in the North, and we are far and away from 1965, and to not acknowledge that is to be disingenuous. One Supreme Court justice cited that there are more blacks that vote in Mississippi than vote in Massachusetts. The black population in the South needs to feel confident and to harness that political power to make sure that the voting venues are not switched just willy-nilly, and to use that voting power and that political power that they now have in their congressmen to make sure that the white population, quote-unquote, cannot just change the voting venues. It is not 1965. They have black congressmen, they have black political leaders, and they have a black voting base in the South that rivals that of the black voting base in the North.
Jay, we got the point. And Vernon Burton, I'd like to come back to you to respond to the point that Jay is making. I mean, she's talking about black political power there that can really take charge of the situation. Do you buy that in the wake of this Supreme Court decision?
Partly, but of course you have the black congressman because of the Voting Rights Act, and partly because of the enforcement of Section 5. A good example of the two places I was involved in the Texas redistricting case, and there Section 5 objected to Texas's, and it had to go back and create opportunity for minorities to elect congressmen. I was also involved with the Black Congressional Caucus in Georgia. They did not object, and the reason is they did not reduce the number of elected African Americans or minorities. But what happens is, of course, then they have very little power because the white Democrats are not elected. It's you know, the Section 5 is certainly not perfect. But if you look, I want to take a little bit of issue with my good friend Keith Gaddis, because I was involved as expert witness in the Charleston case. I love Charleston. I love the people there. But it worked very hard to keep the election structures so that African Americans could not be elected. And then even after that, one of the examples that Ruth Ginsburg gives is, in fact, after that case was decided, they tried to do the very same thing on the school board. So even though these cities are great places, politics is politics, and it's driven so much by partisan. And in the South, where you have a Republican Party, which sort of began to be formed, the new Republican Party came about with the Voting Rights Act and the deliberate courting of whites and identifying the Democratic Party as a party of black people. It gets much more complicated. And will we still have those black congressmen? And particularly, I'm more concerned at the local level, people at the table, at the school boards and the city councils, if, in fact, Section 5 is not enforced, particularly in those areas that Keith has talked about as well, because that's very important to have a voice at the table. It's not that people were just being racist. They did not, in fact, know about the problems or the situations in their community where African-Americans live because of the old patterns of segregation.
Sure. Kareem, go ahead. Kareem, go ahead.
I think there were a lot of important points that were just brought up. I really want to respond to this question about the differences between places like Massachusetts and Mississippi. And the Chief Justice brought that up. And I thought that was one of the most disingenuous parts of his argument. It not only ignores the record, which, again, includes plenty of information showing differences between those places, but it also ignores what we've been talking about. The right to vote isn't just about the ability to cast a ballot. And it is true, if depending on how you count the numbers, that the percentage of African Americans who are voting in Massachusetts is higher than that. Or excuse me, it exceeds the percentage exceeds the number of people voting in Mississippi is larger than Massachusetts. But the point that this misses is the percentage of African Americans overall in Massachusetts is rather small. Yet here's an important difference, and it's one that the Chief Justice totally misses. Massachusetts has a record of electing African Americans statewide. They have an African American governor. They've had an African American senator, by the way, of two different political parties. That is not true in Mississippi. There's a reason for that, and the reason has to do with the unwillingness of whites, as Vernon just mentioned, to support African American preferred candidates, whether they're African American or not. And it also is true in the election of Barack Obama. Barack Obama only won two states in the South, North Carolina and Virginia, and he didn't win North Carolina the last time around. These are persistent structural problems that I think the Chief Justice totally ignores in his analysis, which Congress clearly had in front of it in 2006, and that's what motivated Section 5.
Well, it's a fascinating—
I think President Obama won Florida twice also, didn't he?
And depending on how you count Florida, that's absolutely fair.
Well, gentlemen, I got to jump
in
here.
Can I just add in?
We're actually out of time. Obviously, there's a lot more we could have said, and this conversation continues. Kareem Creighton, professor at the University of North Carolina School of Law, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Keith Gaddy, professor of political science at the University of Oklahoma, thank you as well.
Pleasure to be here.
And Vernon Burton, professor of history at Clemson University. Gentlemen, thank you all three for advancing this important conversation. We're very, very grateful. And listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Anthony Brooks, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.